Welcome to our first episode to begin our second year of the Secular Foxhole Podcast. Robert Trzesinski is back with us today to discuss two of essays he's recently written. Robert, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on again.
It's funny because when I read this essay called The Darkening Age, I had known about the book and I've been reading it. And the way that you draw the parallels, though, between what she had written about the past and today is startling. Can you delve into that for us?
Right. So I wrote an essay called Our Darkening Age.
Thank you, yes.
But it's a reference to a book called The Darkening Age, which it's interesting. I like the title because it's not about the Dark Ages. It's about the Darkening Age, the age that led into the Dark Ages, which is the late classical period. Now, the author of this book, Catherine Nixie, it's an incredibly amusing story that she's the daughter of a former priest and a former monk and a former nun who apparently fell in love, gave up their vocations, and, you know, had her and raised her as a child. So she comes from this Catholic background, but she takes on this sort of self-exculpatory mythology of the Catholic Church, which is, you know, the idea that, well, we're the ones who saved Western civilization. We saved the great ideas of the great books, with all these, you know, monks in their monasteries patiently copying out these old manuscripts. And without us, they wouldn't have survived. So therefore, the church was, you know, preserving the classical world and the legacy of the classical world. And in this mythology, and I think I, to some extent, had even accepted sort of this mental model of it, is that the destruction of the classical world, the destruction of the temples and the statues and the manuscripts and all of that, was because of all these horrible barbarians who came and invaded and destroyed everything. And then the church, you know, had this role at being, you know, at most the church had sort of accidentally caused this destruction indirectly by weakening the defenses of the classical world. But they didn't do the destruction themselves, and in fact they then saved parts of it. Now, and it's true that some monasteries did save manuscripts and recopy the manuscripts. As the picture she paints, I think she has very compelling evidence for it. It's something I'd sort of known a lot of this history before, but nobody had ever put it together in one place quite like this, is that the church Christianity claiming to have saved this stuff from the classical world is like somebody coming and burning your house down and then saying, oh, but we got a couple of half a dozen family photos out of the wreckage, so you should thank me, right? and the Darkening Age is basically her story of the 4th and 5th centuries AD, so the 300s and 400s AD. This is before the final collapse of the Roman Empire in the West. And it was a period in which Christianity was taking over, becoming the dominant religion in the Roman Empire.
Right.
And she has this exhaustive catalog of all the different ways in which the Christians destroyed the legacy of the classical world pretty comprehensively before the barbarians even showed up. So the, you know, Christian mobs would come and they would tear down temples. They would, in some cases, kill classical intellectuals, philosophers and scientists. They would persecute them. In the Eastern Roman Empire, the part that became the Byzantine Empire, never fell to the barbarians at all. You had, in 529 AD, you had a law that basically outlawed all classical institutions of learning. So the academy, you know, Plato's school of philosophy that was still operating in Athens under, you know, some vastly, you know, almost a thousand years later, some successor of Plato, was still a center of learning and of classical philosophy. It was shut down and had to be abandoned, and the whole, you know, the building and the library and all that was all destroyed. Jeez. So she goes comprehensively through this about how much of the classical legacy, the art and the buildings and the books and the ideas, how much of it was destroyed by the Christians within the Roman Empire in service to this idea that, you know, the ascendancy of Christianity had to be completely ascendant. It had to wipe out all competition, all intellectual and spiritual competition, and get rid of all remnants of the ancient world. And there are two key ideas I got out of it, of how it is that, so she doesn't do as much work as I would like in talking about the why of this. What are the fundamental reasons within Christianity why they had to do this? But one that I got out of it is the idea that the Christians brought with them this idea of sort of a a demon-haunted world, right? So that that's actually a phrase borrowed from Carl Sagan.
But yes, really I was going to say.
He wrote a book called The Demon-Haunted World. Right. But he's talking about this sort of mindset, the very mystical mindset where you're constantly beset by demons that are trying to, you know, tear you, to lure you away from the true path of Christianity. And they will literally believe things like, you know, the reason why they defaced the sculptures on the Parthenon is, and they, you know, they got up there and they chipped away and they would literally knock the faces off of them and make them unrecognizable. And the reason they did that is they literally believed that there were demons inside the stones speaking to people and trying to sort of tempt them away from Christianity. So that's why these things had to be destroyed. So that's part of it. But the other part of it that I find most fascinating and most applicable to today is they had this view of the world in which we're all sort of beset by sin and all purpose of life isn't to pursue enjoyment and enlightenment and knowledge and entertainment or pleasure. The goal of life was that you had this whole set of restrictions and rules and sort of ascetic requirements that are imposed on you by the religion, and you live in a sort of constant fear of being found out by God or by your Christian neighbors for having violated some of those rules. Mm-hmm. So this sort of puritanical mindset where life is about a series of restrictions placed on you and you living in constant fear of breaking those restrictions. And that whole mindset and attitude towards life is what was really so opposite of the classical world, where, you know, I'm a big student of Aristotle, and, you know, Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, the whole, which is typical of all ethics of the, all the ethics of the classical world were very similar to this, which is the assumption is your basic goal in life is to be happy. And the purpose of ethics is to give you advice on how to be happy and how to sort of achieve a sort of personal fulfillment and pleasure and enjoyment in life. And the only question is, well, how? What is the most important kind of pleasure? What is the most important kind of happiness, and how do you achieve that? And that was that's a real strong dividing line between the classical and the Christian world, is where happiness is no longer the purpose of life, and living up to this sort of vast, overbearing set of restrictions, that's the fundamental goal of life.
Yeah, I've heard all my life, true happiness is serving God, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So,
and that's even the more hardcore would say, you know, happiness in this world is irrelevant. It's immaterial. And in fact, the more miserable, you know, that she talks a lot about the rise of the monastic movement. So these guys going out into the desert and starving themselves and living in isolation and, you know, all these excesses of self-flagellation and of self-denial, where the excess of self-denial was the whole point. The whole point was to show I'm miserable in this life. And the more I can heap up my misery, the better off I'll be, because I really should be focused on the next life. You know, that, and that's all in the Sermon on the Mount. That's all. That's all contained in Christianity. You know, don't pile up your treasure here on earth. Pile up your treasure in heaven. So that's all there in the Sermon on the Mount. But they took it to these fanatical extremes. The monks did, and you know, it was a huge movement, especially in North Africa. In the fourth century. So that's the real dividing line in outlooks. And I think that has a lot of relevance to today, because I think you're seeing some of that same sort of attitude, that sort of wallowing in a sense of guilt, of being obsessed with your guilt and with, am I living up to these exacting little rules? Place I'd go to recommend to look at that for the parallels to today is the New York Times. So I get these, you know, notices from the New York Times in my email inbox, sort of various features they have. And the one that always fascinates me is one called, I think it's called The Ethicist. And it's an ethics column where you have a so-called expert in ethics who is there to answer. It's like an advice column, but it's an expert in ethics who's there to answer your questions. And the questions that come in are of such a consistent nature. So it's things like, you know, I'm teaching some sort of meditation or something like that to students that I have. Am I guilty of cultural appropriation? I'm thinking of having a child through in vitro fertilization. A single woman wanting to have a child through basically getting a sperm donor says, you know, is it acceptable to have a child of another race? Since I'm white, you know, if I were to get a child who was black, would that be better or worse? What's the most acceptable, you know, morally ethical thing? And the idea of, like, what do you want? What's your personal desire? What's your goal? Never enters into it for these people. It's always, there is this code coming down from above, the set of sins that you need to avoid, and you're constantly in fear that I'm somehow violating this code. And it struck me as being so much like that Christian attitude. I mean, it is the Christian attitude. It's just become, we're still living in this post-Christian era. It's just become secularized in terms of its actual content. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the basic outlook and this fear that sin is everywhere, sin is constant and all-consuming, and you are constantly in fear of being lured off the straight path, and you can't consult your own desires for happiness or your own, you know, your own sense of what you would like and what you would enjoy. You have to have constantly this constant fear of violating these restrictions coming from above. That's what remains constant from the Christian era.
Right. Yeah, the secularization of Christianity, and well, I think, and I'll just throw this out there. I think I mentioned this to you in your last appearance, or maybe someone, that all Marx did was substitute the word state for the word God. Everything is the same. Every other moral tenet that he preached was the same as Christianity.
Yeah, I think last time we also talked about Auguste Comte, who's this early 19th century French
philosopher. Yes.
And he really set out very deliberately and very openly, you know, to create a religion, a secular version of religion that was built around altruism. And
I see.
Yeah, I think so. The idea, you know, this comparison of, oh, it's kind of like religion. Well, it was designed to be exactly like Christianity, but just translated over into secular form. That was the whole point of what Comte did, and he basically succeeded at it. And we're still living in that era. And you know, what really struck me about the Catherine Nixie book about about the Darkening Age is I had had this on my radar screen for a while. The story actually is back when I was writing for the Federalist, I was spending a lot more time sort of in private behind the scenes discussions with religious conservatives. It was, you know, because a bunch of my fellow writers at that publication were of that persuasion.
Yeah. So I said, sure.
I got more of an up close look at how do they think about things. And I remember when that book came out, this is 2017 that the book came out. Nixie did an op-ed in the New York Times based on the book, sort of summarizing the thing. And the response that it got among some of the religious conservatives, that was sort of privately, in private discussions, was sort of the response I normally see when you get somebody who's defending the indefensible, which is, it never happened and we totally do it again. And It's you know, not to make it too invidious a comparison, but you see this a lot with the Holocaust denial set, which is the Holocaust didn't happen, but it would have been totally justified if it did. You know, they always sort of straddle the line on that, because what they really want to do is they really want to defend the indefensible. They want to defend the horrible things that were done. So they have to deny it and at the same time affirming it. And that was sort of the response that I got from some of the religious today's, you know, contemporary religious conservatives, is that no, this whole thing about how Christians destroyed the classical world is totally exaggerated. It's based, you know, it's based on only partial evidence, and she's leaving out all these things. But the demons really were talking people out of the stones, so that's why they had to be destroyed. I mean, they still have that demon haunted world mindset. So I've had this book on my list to look at for a long time. But the great coincidence here, well, not entirely a coincidence, it was part of what prompted me to finally get around to it. But I happened to finally get around to it and start reading it on the weekend that here in Charlottesville, Virginia, suddenly, like, made all the old statues disappear. They had one weekend where suddenly they swooped in and they took away a bunch of, they took away the Confederate generals. They took away Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee, who were downtown and by the courthouse. But at the same time, they also got rid of George Rogers Clark and Lewis and Clark. Lewis and Clark were explorers, Confederate generals. But the Lewis and Clark statue has Sacagawea, and she portrayed. It's actually interesting. It's one of the first sculptures to portray her, because at the time she was getting a lot more notice, and so she was getting a lot more credit for having been part of the expedition
Sure.
But it portrays her in a insufficiently heroic manner, and so it's been targeted as, oh, showing Native Americans as secondary and as second-class citizens or something, some argument like that. So they got rid of that one, and then they got rid of George Rogers Clark. He was William Clark from Lewis and Clark. George Rogers Clark was his uncle. Again, another Native Albemarle County local, you know, hero. He was a Revolutionary War general who had fought in the Northwest Territories, which at the time was like Ohio, was the Northwest, right?
Okay, right, yeah.
And he had fought against Indian tribes who were allied to the British. And he had won a series of crucial battles out there, basically keeping the British from taking over the Western areas and coming at us from the West. So here's a Revolutionary War hero and two explorers. They also had sculptures, local sculptures, and those were taken down. And that they haven't been destroyed, but they've sort of been taken out for storage somewhere. And maybe somebody will be allowed to get them and display them in a museum somewhere. But the fate of them is still very uncertain. So it really struck home to me, though, because I'm driving around town and suddenly here are these statues that are part of the normal everyday life if you live in this area. And you drive by them and, you know, you drive by this intersection where they have this Lewis and Clark statue all the time. And suddenly there's just like the base of the statue is there and the whole thing's gone. And I'm reading about, you know, in the late classical era, these fanatical mobs of Christians coming in and destroying or removing the classical sculptures from the temples or from the public spaces. So the parallels were really driven home to me. In a visceral and an immediate way.
Yeah, I can't argue with that.
I'm really fascinated by this idea of the attitude, the fundamental attitude towards morality. And it's something even beneath the question of what the content of morality is. But the idea of morality, I think Ayn Rand described it once as morality as a scarecrow. And I think that's the fundamentality of that attitude, that morality is about what you have to destroy, what you have to get rid of, what you have to purge from your life. And morality is not about what do you add to your life, what do you go out and accomplish and achieve. It's about what you purge and what you destroy. And that, I think, is the most fundamental. It's like the almost pre-moral attitude. It's so much at the base of your whole approach to morality. And that's what I see as being the real sort of common thread there, the element of Christianity that we've never gotten beyond, as much as people are heathens and unbelievers in so many other ways today.
Good point.
I get thinking about the book, The Name of a Rose, and especially the movie with the same name based on the book. Do you have any thoughts, comments on that?
I may have read the book at one point, but I remember the movie, which is very, because, you know, it's Sean Connery. It's very vivid.
Yep. Yes.
Yeah, and I think there's the fundamental conflict in that movie, as I recall, is about the disappearance of a version, a copy, like the last remaining copy of Aristotle's comedy, book on comedy, and it's considered scandalous by the monks because the line that really jumps out is there's, I think, Yorgi, the Venerable Yorgi, I think is the guy's name, that this sort of malevolent old monk, who's sort of the one who's trying to suppress and get rid of this book by Aristotle. And he says, laughter distorts the face like a monkey. And he has this whole sermon he gives, inveighing against the idea of laughter and enjoyment as such. And yeah, that really captures that spirit, that monastic spirit, and the way in which it is sort of resolutely against any kind of enjoyment of life. And like I said, I think we're still sort of living in the hangover of that, as sometimes as heated, as secular and often even hedonistic as our culture sometimes appears, that the ghost of that approach to morality is still animating a lot of what we see around us.
Let me throw this in, bring it back to a modern thing too. But I love that book and that movie, by the way. But and you might have a more personal view of this. Why did these deeply devout evangelicals embrace Donald Trump? I mean, here's a womanizing, et cetera, et cetera. Power lusting, I guess. Guy with nothing better to do. He wants to be president.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a big mystery that a lot of people have plumbed. And the guy I like to read, one of the people I like to read about is that about on that issue is David French. You know, there was a while back, you remember that he was, there was one of these nationalist conservatives that wrote an article against David Frenchism.
And, oh, gosh, yeah.
And I said, well, you know, I kind of signed up as a David Frenchist in some ways because, you know, as ridiculous as it is, I talked to David French. I know him. We've corresponded over the years. And I said, you know, did you ever imagine in your life you would be an ism? And he's as mystified as anybody else on that. He was supposed to represent sort of a wishy-washy approach towards religion, and specifically a wishy-washy classical liberal approach to religion that doesn't regard the goal of a religious conservative as being to seize power. And that's the real thing they have against David French. So he has some really interesting things coming from that evangelical world about being something of a classical liberal, about how they've, you know, been sort of distorted by this quest for power. But I think that's it. It's why did they embrace a hedonistic, essentially unbelieving, non-Christian, in any reasonable sense, power luster? Well, I think it's the power lust. That's what attracted them to it, is the idea that politics is all about gaining and seizing power for your side. It's a fascinating thing. I did a podcast a while back for a symposium. I did a podcast with a German scholar called Tobias Kremer. And he's done a lot of interviews with right-wing populist movements in Europe, and sort of exploring this fascinating thing that he says for them, they are all described themselves as pro-Christian, and being Christian is like central to the sales pitch they make. So think of Viktor Orban in Hungary and the National Front in France, that sort of thing. Christianity for them is sort of a marker for getting power for their side in the culture war. But he says if you actually look at, you know, theologically, in terms of the theological issues, in terms of the actual substance of religion, they don't really care that much about it. Religion for them has become a sort of slogan that they use to try to seize power, power for my side over your side, as they define it in the culture wars. So, you know, it's one of the things that people have puzzled over for thousands of years, I mean, since the rise of Christianity, which is when religion tries to use the power to gain and acquire the power of the state for its purposes, the state also acquires power over religion. And religion comes to be defined in terms of the goals of the state, because, you know, the state, as the sponsor of religion, gets to start dictating the terms of what the religion should be. And I think, from what I gather, Catherine Nixie's working on a new book, and from what I gather, she's going to be writing about that, because what happens is, when Christianity becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire under Constantine, one of the first things Constantine does is he says, let's get a council together, let's decide what Christian doctrine is, and let's declare everything that is not the official Christian doctrine to be heresy, which is to be stamped out. And one of the things people don't realize is, and this is what her book, from what I gather, is going to be about, is that there were all these different variations of Christianity for the, you know, 200 or 300 years after Christ. All these different theories about what's the nature of the Trinity that people were trying to puzzle out and make sense of, especially make sense of it within the context of classical philosophy. So, you know, this idea of the Trinity in Christianity, that sure. God is three people and he's one person, right? So he's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, but he's only one God. And it makes no logical sense. That you bring that into the classical world, into these people who are basically educated on Aristotle or on something derived from Aristotle. And they start asking these questions like, well, how can he be three and one, all at once? How can he be fully divine and fully mortal? That doesn't make any sense. And they developed all these theories to try to come to some solution of that. And a lot of them were basically trying to take Christianity and make it compatible with the categories of classical philosophy, which of course is kind of a, you know, a fool's errand to try to do that. But they were trying to incorporate it within their own intellectual framework. Well, all those different versions of Christianity basically get wiped out the minute it gets the sponsorship of the state. So, you know, the religion looks to the state for support, but then once it gets the state for support, the state then dictates the content of the religion. And I think you see something similar to that happening with Christianity as it's used at the right-wing populist movements today in Europe, and also in the Trump phenomenon, that support for Donald Trump, which is sort of a stand-in for an attempt to try to seize the power of the government, becomes a goal in and of itself that then distorts, when that becomes the goal of Christians, it actually distorts the content and meaning of their Christianity. And here's another parallel, to draw a parallel from another area. About 10 years or so ago, I did some research on Islamic fundamentalism. And I found that one of the big innovations made by Osama bin Laden on the one hand, and in the Sunni realm, it was by Zawahiri, Ayman Zawahiri, who's Osama bin Laden's number two man.
Right.
But his theorist, really. It was the theorist of Al-Qaeda. It was Zawahiri. So in the Sunni world, this was done by Zawahiri. And in the Shiite Muslim world, it was done by the Ayatollah Khomeini. Is both of them developed theories that basically in traditional Islam, if you want to do something, if you want a fatwa that will allow you to, you know, attack the Americans or something like that, you would have to go out and find an approved religious scholar, you know, somebody who had come up through the ranks of the religious scholars within Islam, who had religion, has the authority of his scholarship behind him. And you'd have to ask him, please give me a fatwa saying that it's religiously okay to mount this attack. So people might remember that way back in the 1990s, the first attack on the World Trade Center, the one where they bombed it, but they didn't knock it down.
You're right, 93, yeah.
Yeah, then there's actually a guy, a Muslim priest in America who had all these followers, a blind sheikh, who was actually tried and put in jail for being the guy who was the religious scholar who gave his approval to his followers to attack the World Trade Center. Right, so this is the old model. Well, Zawahiri comes along in the 90s, and before him in Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini came along, and they developed a theory where the very necessity of attacking the Americans becomes a sanction that gives the terrorist leader his own authority above that of all the scholars. So, you know, Zawahiri came up with this idea that simply by being a warrior who strikes against the unbelievers, Osama bin Laden gains religious authority from the mere fact of his being able to be good at wielding force and attacking people and killing people and exercising terror against them, right? So this idea that and it's the same sort of dilemma you see, that the desire for political power for religion gives the political leader the ability to define what the religion even is. And the Khomeini did that in Iran. Bin Laden did that with Al-Qaeda. And I think, not to be too strained in an analogy, that Donald Trump is basically Osama bin Laden. But,
no, okay.
But it's this universal dilemma of the relationship between state power, political power, and religion. And it draws you into the same, you know, in various different forms, to various different degrees, whether it's in the ancient world, whether it's in a modern America, whether it's in the Middle East, it draws you into the same dilemmas. And I think that's the dilemma of the Christian Trumpist, which is they look to him as being the guy who's finally going to seize political power and use it on our behalf. He's going to be an American Caesar, or an American sort of the American version of a Byzantine emperor. Right, mm-hmm. who combines religious and political authority and uses it on our behalf and uses it to suppress the unbelievers and suppress anybody who's in competition with us in the culture wars. And I think that was the lure that they had towards Trump. And the very fact that he's unrestrained by all the usual inhibitions that a politician would have. So the very fact of, the fact that he's has such a louche personal life reflects the fact that he is unrestrained by all the conventional rules and the conventional expectations, that he's willing to just go out and break all the rules and all the norms and all the precedents. And that was what really attracted, the very thing that makes him a heathen is what attracted them to him, because he was somebody who was going to seize political power on behalf of American religion, use it to beat down their enemies. And, you know, they have legitimate complaints against some of the secular enemies of religion today who are very intolerant of religion, you know, in their own turn.
True.
But it was that quest for political power that I think really did them in.
Well, what, is there any correlation or parallel with the woke on the left?
Well, I think absolutely, because they have the same sort of compulsion to gain power. And I don't know that it's found focus around a specific political leader at this point, which I suppose you should be grateful for the fact that, you know, Joe Biden is too old and worn out and too old-fashioned in and of himself to be a focus for that sort of thing. And I don't think they found any other single leader that would be sort of the spokesman for the woke ideology. But they have, you know, they have a different route because, you know, the right needed a populist strongman because they needed somebody who would come from outside of the institutions. Because the institutions in America are very dominated by the left. They're dominated by the woke.
Yes.
So, you know, if you go to the press, if you go to the universities, if you go to the big corporations, all of those things, the respectable institutions, are very dominated by the woke side. So you needed somebody who would create this illusion that I'm outside of all of that. I can come speaking for the people, or at least for the people who matter, right? Mm-hmm. Populists are always in favor of the people, but always their faction being identified as the people.
Yes,
and I can go for that faction, and I can speak for them, and I can go around all the institutions and impose my views on the institutions from the outside. The woke people don't need that. They don't need the populist leader. What they, because they have the institutions, they control the institutions, or they have at least intimidated everyone inside the institutions. So I think they don't have quite the same need for the populist outsider leader. They can sort of do it by the overall pressure coming from all sides from the institutions.
Well, I can verify that at the corporate level. The company that I work for folded like a tent, you know, when they got the first sign of pressure from the woke, the woke mob, if you will. Sadly.
Yeah, big institutions tend to be very timid, and they tend to be very, you know, and there, you have big corporations, as large corporations especially, mm-hmm. tend to be, you know, they have a large managerial class, and that managerial class is drawn from people who went to universities and got degrees at universities.
Oh, yeah.
And absorbed all these ideas, and at the very least are afraid of those ideas. They don't have the...
They don't have the ammunition, if you will, intellectual ammunition to counteract it.
They've been trained to give a certain deference to those ideas as being, at the very worst, misguided idealism, right?
Well, yeah.
And so you don't dare stand up against it, because who are you? You know, you don't want to be called a racist. And you don't have the ability, you haven't identified it as this is something that needs to be firmly opposed. And if you don't go in already fortified to be opposed to it, then you just don't be, you know, the pressure is so great that you don't stand a chance. You know, it's something I've noticed. It's a bit of a developing into an idea that I think I'm going to start making a bigger deal of, which is that, you know, one thing I've noticed is you can say in the abstract that courage is a virtue. But I found that your ability to actually exercise that virtue depends on practice. You know, courage is a virtue, but virtues need to be exercised. They need
That's to, true.
To the extent that a virtue refers not just to a set of actions you ought to take, but also to an ingrained quality of character. Right? Character is acquired, as Aristotle has said, we are what we repeatedly do.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, you know, I ascribe a lot of this, a lot of my advantages to the fact that as somebody who writes and advocates in the field of politics, I ascribe a lot of my advantages to the fact that my sister was mean to me when we were kids. because, you know, but it literally, it gave me the practice, like the everyday practice of being able to tune out hostility. To the point where, you know, I've been in arguments, I've been in political discussions, and somebody come up to me later and said, "Wow, how do you stand up to all that hostility?" I was like, "That was hostile? I didn't notice. Right? It's nothing compared to what my sister put me through."
We thank Robert's sister for
it. No, we're friends now, and we're now.
Oh, certainly.
But, sure. But, you know, my dad was right. It builds character, right? But I do think that's true, though, that there are a lot of people who would probably think courage and independence are virtues in the abstract. But on the other hand, they're used to going through life without really encountering a lot of conflict. And when a whole bunch of people come yelling at them saying, how could you possibly say this? How could you possibly think this? What a terrible person you must be. They're not prepared to handle it. And so if you haven't exercised that virtue, if you haven't prepared yourself to fight for what you know is right against the sort of the mob, it's going to be very, very hard on a sort of emotional and sense of life level. It's going to be very hard to hold up that resistance. And I think social media sort of amplifies that, because I think that as a culture, and especially in corporate cultures, they haven't absorbed yet how social media works. Because, you know, I remember the old days where if you had, you know, if people had to actually get on the phone and telephone your corporate offices, or if they had to sit down and write something and send it in the mail, people had to go through a lot of work to contact you. And so if you got 20,000 people telling you they really disapproved of something you were doing as a corporation, you would absolutely panic and think, we must be doing something horribly wrong. You know, for every one of these people, there must be 10 more who also hates us, of our customers who also hate us. Mm-hmm. And you'd panic. Well, when you bring that over to the social media era, where in order for 20,000 people to tell you something, it takes them like 3 seconds and they click a button, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's such a totally minimal element. So getting 20,000 people surging into your corporate Twitter account to tell you how much they're mad at you doesn't mean anything at all. It's just Tuesday, right? It's just another day on the internet. It means nothing, but you have a lot of corporate leaders who are still in the old mindset. They're still in the mindset, if 20,000 people are mad at us, we must be in big, big trouble. Instead of saying, you know, this is Twitter, wait 24 hours, they'll all march off after somebody else and ignore us. So that's why I think, you know, again, they panic and they fold, because they don't have the mindset of being prepared to resist these things. And then that's exaggerated, or it's amplified by the fact that they're not really used to the way things work on social media, and that the numbers you get on social media don't mean what they would mean if in the old system.
Mm, that's a great point, though. It's a great point. We touched on politics, and we've touched on racism. Do you want to segue into your second essay there, Rob?
This is one that's coming out in the next week or so, but it's an idea I've been toying with for a while, and I finally got the chance to sort of nail it down and make it exact and really get to the bottom of it in a way. And that is, you know, I said that religion is being used as sort of a stalking horse for a quest for power, and how religion gets assorted by what it becomes part of a quest for power. And I think the modern woke religion is, in a way, it's suffering the same problem. So it's supposed to be about anti-racism and opposition to racism. But race and racism have been redefined not to refer to the actual phenomenon of different races within the human species, not to refer to the actual phenomenon of racism, but to be used as a bludgeon for an actual political agenda, and specifically for an anti-capitalist political agenda. You know, I think there's a phenomenon that's been happening recently. One of the things that a lot of us got amusement out of is when the New York Times came out with the 1619 Project, you know, this argument about how slavery is the real foundation of America, it's the real legacy. Some of the best, most trenchant critiques of that came from the Worldwide Socialist website. We're like, well, why are the socialists doing this? Well, it was this internal thing within the left that they're saying, no, class and Marxist class warfare is the real central issue. We should be focused on that and not on race. So there was this war within the left. And so the general viewpoint is that the old-fashioned Marxist class warfare, anti-capitalism, has been eclipsed by this new fascination with race. But when I started looking into it, I realized that that's actually, looks are deceiving.
Okay.
And what's actually happened is the opposite, that the issue of race has been taken over by the anti-capitalists. And that to be white, or whiteness, which is the new term they use, is actually defined in essence by an acceptance of capitalism and the American system, whereas being non-white is defined, and or being anti-racist is defined by your opposition to capitalism and the American system. And the odd little nexus, I finally got to the root of it, a book I'd heard about before, I didn't realize how central it was to this. So there's a guy, a Harvard professor, he's actually a former Marxist agitator who worked at a factory trying to rally the workers for decades. And then when that went bust, he went to Harvard and got a PhD and wrote this book. And the book is called How the Irish Became White.
Oh, my.
And, of course, you know, I'm part Irish, but this is like blood in my mind. It's like, what are you doing? You know, these are the palest human beings who have ever walked the earth. They are absolutely melanin deficient. They've lived for thousands of years on an island that's like 52 degrees north latitude. It's practically in the Arctic Circle. They're the palest people you will ever find. How is it they quote-unquote became white? Well, there's not really any evidence linguistically that the Irish were ever, ever, ever referred to anything as other than white. There is evidence they were viewed as a different race back in, you know, 100, 150 years ago when, you know, the races of the world were, well, you got the Irish and you got the Polacks and you got the Italians and the Yugoslavs and, you know, every little nationality within Europe was considered a separate race. But it wasn't a white versus black or white versus non-white. It was that they had this granular, very particular idea of what race was every little nationality. But what if you look at the book, the guy's name is Ignatieff, who wrote it. And if you look at his book, the basic theory is that it's really talking about how the Irish immigrants were originally discriminated against in America. Now, they're viewed as drunks, they're viewed as unreliable, they're viewed as uncivilized, what have you. All the things you'll hear said about other immigrants today. And then they're eventually accepted and became mainstream and accepted as equals within American society. And now, this guy is an old-fashioned, unreconstructed Marxist, and he says the way they became accepted within mainstream society and therefore became quote-unquote white is because they made it in the capitalist system. They succeeded and rose up and get into the middle class and basically became co-opted by the capitalist system and didn't, instead of viewing themselves as being fellow workers oppressed by the bourgeoisie, they became the bourgeoisie. And so it was, again, this is the guy who set the idea that acceptance of the American system, and specifically of the capitalist system, is the marker of what makes you white or what makes for whiteness, and that resistance to capitalism is the essence of, and he identified resistance to capitalism as the essence of the attack on racism. And this is done by this guy, you know, this white guy, old white Marxist named Ignatieff, you know, 25 years ago or more, give or take, I think it was 95. So about 25 years ago, long before, you know, all the anti-racist stuff that you're hearing now came along, but he was the one who set that direction. And that's sort of the source for this idea. But it's interesting how it defines race in terms of the old Marxist anti-capitalist politics. So really it looks on the outside as if race has eclipsed the old Marxism. But actually what's happened is the old Marxism has redefined the very concept of race and the very concept of racism to use it as a vehicle for anti-capitalism.
It came from Harvard.
And as usual, yes, it sounds like a horror movie. It came from Harvard.
It is a horror movie. But what concerns me...
This piece is coming out in Discourse magazine, which is a...
Yes, thank you.
Relatively new publication from Mercatus, a free market think tank.
Good.
It's coming out in probably about a week from now.
Good. That's great. And I'll look for it there too. But thank you for sending me a copy. What's always concerned me, and I've noticed this for many, many decades, frankly, since I've read Rand and others, conservatives are always the lapdogs. They're always the me too kind of, I better say this because I want to be accepted kind of thing. Now they've, because of Trump, or I mean, I think he's decimated the GOP. They've rejected individualism. They've rejected capitalism. They rejected all the things that made America exceptional, if you will.
Yeah.
Where do we go to start to correct that?
We have to go back to basic ideas, which is what I'm trying to do with Symposium, is get people to go back and talk about some of those basic ideas. And another thing I've got coming in the works, we talked a little, I mentioned this to you before, And I haven't quite gotten around to it yet because I've got all these other things going on. And Afghanistan came up in the last week or so. And
sure.
And sucked all the time. I had spent a lot of time keeping up with that. But I've got a review coming up of Brad Thompson's book, America's Revolutionary Mind.
Yes. And,
you know, the title of my review is going to be How to Think Like the Founders. Because what really struck me about his book is how radically different the thinking method of the founders is when it comes to politics compared to what we have today. Mm-hmm. So the founders, it was habitual for the founding fathers and for Americans of the founding era. And you see this not just from Jefferson and Adams, but you'll see it in like newspaper editorials by some farmer in Vermont, right? And their habit was when a political question comes up about like a tax on sugar, they would go back and say, well, let's talk about why we have government in the first place and why government was formed and what were its purposes. And they go back to first principles as a matter of habit, that it was a sort of normal ingrained approach to them to immediately go back to what is the purpose of government in the first place. And there'd be some tiny little tax on sugar, some minutiae of the day, and that would immediately bring them back to what are the fundamental principles. And that's the mental habit we've lost that I think we need to bring back. Oh. And that's sort of what I call how to think like the founders, is how to go back to basic principles on things instead of just being, you know, I think what did in the Republican Party, what did in modern conservatism, is that it's so completely reactive.
Yeah.
It's reactive against whatever, you know, whatever the left is doing, we're against it. And we're going to become, in the process, become a mirror image of it, right?
Yep.
And they let themselves get distorted by what their enemies are for. And it's because they do not have so many people in American politics do not have that mental habit the founders have of going back to philosophical first principles and asking the basic questions when dealing with the political problems of their day. And so that's one of the things that I think really needs to be rediscovered. I think Brad's book, I think, does a great job of it. And it's something that I'm trying to do with everything else I'm doing, is rediscover that habit of thinking like the founders, thinking in terms of basic principles.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Martin, do you have anything to add?
No, that sounds good, like a good ending, but we could see some positive signs also. So do you have anything else that you want to say, Rob, about future plans or something more?
I don't know if I have any future plans to. I've already told you about two articles I haven't written.
Yes.
Written. Well, one I've written that has been published, and one that I haven't quite written yet. It's one, you know, it's one of those articles. It's there. It's all up there in my head, but it hasn't gotten down into electrons yet.
Well, great. Well, and we've been talking with Robert Trzynski, the founder and editor of Symposium, a journal of liberalism, and the Trzynski Letter. Robert, it was great to have you. Thanks for manning the foxhole with us.
Yeah,
always a pleasure to have you be on.
Thanks.
Great. Thanks.